Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health policy, health innovation, and technology, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Norman Sharpless, director of the National Cancer Institute at the National Institutes of Health. He discusses significant changes ahead in creating a more personalized approach to cancer diagnosis and treatment based on one's own genome and the need to foster more sharing of research across institutions around the country and the world. Laurie Robertson also checks in, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter at chcradio. We love hearing from you. Or find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or ask Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Norman Sharpless, director of the National Cancer Institute, on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Norman Sharpless, director of the National Cancer Institute at the National Institute of Health, leader of the National Cancer Program, the world's leading cancer research funder. Dr. Sharpless served as director of the University of North Carolina Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center. Dr. Sharpless is also chief of the Aging Biology and Cancer Section in the National Institute of Aging's Laboratory of Genetics and Genomics. Dr. Sharpless earned his medical degree with honors from the UNC School of Medicine, completing his residency at Mass General Hospital. Dr. Sharpless, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, you know, since you've taken on the reins of the National Cancer Institute, much seems to be possible given the increasing in data computation, more scientific discovery around genomics and machine learning and personalized medicine. And what are you most excited about in terms of the pace of research and discovery? And what do you see as some of the big challenges yet to overcome?
Well, I think, you have to sort of have two statements in mind about cancer research and cancer care in the United States at present. The first one is, we are making progress in cancer research and cancer care at a pace that is greater than at any point in my time in my career as an oncologist. New discoveries, new therapies, new ways of treating patients. This has been built on, you know, decades of elegant basic science, understanding how cancer works. And now those scientific endeavors are paying off, and we're developing new therapies and better ways of treating patients and better ways of preventing cancer at all the time. So a pace of progress that is really breathtaking. But at the same time, while we've made a lot of progress, that progress is not good enough. We still have a long ways to go. There's still too many people dying of cancer in the United States. And in particular, the progress has been uneven. So we've had a lot more progress in a disease like melanoma, you know, skin cancer, than we've had in a cancer like brain cancer, like glioblastoma. So against that background, I'd say, you know, something that is very exciting right now is, as you mentioned, the ability to aggregate large data sets and learn from every patient. And then, you know, because we realize that cancers are very personalized and precise entities, and each person's cancer is somewhat different, even if they all look a little bit under the same under the microscope. So that ability to, you know, learn from every patient by aggregating data is very exciting, as is these new therapeutic modalities like immuno-oncology and new ways of doing radiation and surgery and chemotherapy. The challenges, though, are that, you know, there are some cancers where we still need a better basic science understanding. There's some barriers to implementing successful care that are problematic. So we have therapies that work, but getting them in widespread use is still a problem. In some areas, we have so much success. We have so many different ways of treating things that a real challenge is how to put all those things together and use them. So how to integrate care and make comprehensive care for patients is becoming a challenge.
Well, Dr. Sharpless, when you stepped into the role as director of the National Cancer Institute, you identified four key areas of research that you felt needed to be paid particular attention to at NCI in order to improve the research landscape. What are these focus areas, and how are they driving the Institute's overall research agenda, and I assume will over the next several years?
You know, as I entered federal service, having been an academic, I spent a lot of time taking stock of how the NIH works and the NCI works, and you know, some things that National Cancer Institute does well and other areas where we could make improvements. And that involved, you know, a learning and listening tour where I went and spoke to people for, you know, patients and doctors and scientists and advocates about, you know, where we could make progress more rapidly. And from that exercise, I did identify four areas. And so the four things that we came up with were first a real focus on workforce development, on training the future scientists and doctors that will take care of patients with cancer in the future. I would argue this is possibly the most important thing the NCI does, is we have a large amount of spending on training grants and training exercises and making sure doctors and scientists are well equipped for the future of cancer research. The second is a steadfast commitment to basic science. While we've made a lot of progress in our scientific understanding of cancer, we're not done yet. We still need to do these very detailed and careful and in some cases elegant basic investigation of cancer to understand exactly how it works, because that's where the therapeutic ideas really come from. A third is this focusing on how we use data. You know, we have a lot of data in oncology. We get data from patients, from scientific studies, from outcomes and prevention trials, and all these different data sets are not well linked, and they're not easy to research for scientists to go into these data sets and understand what's happening to patients with cancer. And so getting aggregated and shared data that's useful. And the fourth is we really have to sort of reimagine, if you will, how we do clinical trials in cancer research. So every therapy that we use successfully in cancer right now is the result of a successful clinical trial. But at the same time, because of a variety of issues, making progress through clinical trials has become more difficult in cancer research over the last two decades. And so I think we're really focusing on how to make trials efficient and ethical for the patient so that we can provide everyone with the best care.
Dr. Sharpless, I think the public, when they think about the progress that we're making, is looking for this cure for cancer. But we're really looking at more than 100 different related diseases and possibly thousands, and all of these are influenced by this complex network of factors. I'm wondering how you're viewing the role of personalized medicine in this context as well, and how that will benefit the direction that you and your colleagues are headed.
Right. I think the appreciation that cancer is very heterogeneous, that, you know, even we have two breast cancers, they look the same under the microscope. We thought of them as the same disease, but really we've become to understand that, you know, even tumors that look quite similar microscopically to a pathologist can be very different in their molecular underpinnings of the tumor. And so that appreciation that what we used to think of as being similar things like lung cancer or breast cancer, you know, really are very heterogeneous entities where almost every patient needs a personalized or a precision approach. I believe that's one of the major advances in cancer research of the last few decades. And it's really changed how we do things. You know, it's changed the clinical trials enterprise. It's changed how we take care of patients. So it has really had a widespread implication in all areas of our field. You know, what it means for patients who have advanced cancer is that, you know, the doctors who are taking care of them will want more studies of their tumor than we used to do. So we used to sort of just look at the tumor under the microscope and say, yep, that's cancer, you need this and that. Now we have to do additional work. The pathologists are asked to molecularly classify the tumors in terms of their expression of various proteins. But then that information is used to provide a therapy for the patient that is, you know, intended for them. This is good news for patients in many ways because it means they get a therapy that is, you know, more likely to work, that is less toxic. And using this approach, we are starting to cure patients. We really can say now, as opposed to just, you know, prolonged remission, that we're curing cancers that we used to, you know, consider untreatable. So that's great progress. But at the same time, that fragmentation of cancer research, you know, realizing that we're not dealing with 10 diseases but thousands of diseases, makes the cancer research enterprise much more difficult. We really have to not aggregate them in big groups. And that is a much more complicated endeavor for a clinical trial, for example. So precision oncology has provided a means whereby we can make progress in lots of these individual diseases if we take them one at a time. But it's also proven that there's no sort of magic silver bullet that will cure all cancers. We realize that now is a vain hope of the past. Really what we need now are, you know, very effective therapies for each of these disparate different kinds of cancer. And using that approach, we're making a lot of progress.
Dr. Sharpless, talk a little bit about screening and early detection. We have taken ownership in the public health and the primary care world of trying to start with prevention, right? But this whole arena of screening and early detection remains an area of some controversy. We follow the evidence-based guidelines, what to screen for, given the availability of access to people's genetic profiles. What do you think we might see in the coming years over any major changes around how we think about screening for the purpose of early detection?
Yeah, this is a fascinating area. And, you know, some of the major victories in cancer care of the last few decades have really been related to the area of prevention. So if you look at the progress we're now making in terms of tobacco control is great news, as, you know, tobacco-associated cancers are prevalent and very deadly. And, you know, as we reduce the usage of tobacco in the community, we will see a decline in those kinds of cancers. I think, you know, the dissemination of vaccines to prevent cancer, both the hepatitis B vaccine and HPV, human papillomavirus vaccines, those will prevent cancers. Yep. and are useful. And we know obesity is related to cancer. So those areas of prevention, you know, avoiding mutagens like sunlight and tobacco and staying thin and getting your vaccines, things I think most of us can agree on as very effective, very useful prevention measures. But then the topic gets harder, as you alluded. So, mm-hmm. you know, who should we screen for cancer and what? We think that screening for cervical cancer, pap smears, is highly effective and has led to a widespread decline in that cancer in the United States and other countries. We think that a colonoscopy is highly effective for preventing colon cancer, and is an area where I think we'd like to see increased usage of colon cancer screening. Mammography and PSA testing are both more complicated conversations, and generally we refer patients to their doctors to discuss whether or not they're appropriate person based on their age and risk, because those tests, they are effective at finding cancer, but they're also sometimes will find indolent cancers that will not hurt the patient and so can lead to overdiagnosis and overtreatment. So, you know, how to use those tests appropriately in the community is where I think we need additional research. One hope I have is, just like precision oncology has helped us in the area of therapy, I think a better understanding of an individual's precise cancer risk will make prevention somewhat easier. So, you know, a test like PSA testing, which may be more valuable in patients because of their family history, their age, and their genetic risk, you know, one could have a sort of personalized approach to prevention that might make that kind of general screening more useful, where we maximize the chances of catching a cancer early and treating it effectively, and minimize the chances of finding, you know, unimportant cancer that is, you know, leads to overdiagnosis and overscreening. So I think that personalized oncology is not just for therapy. It is also an important part of prevention and making sure we treat every patient appropriately based on their sort of lifetime risk of cancer. One thing that we're going to need to do more of, I think, for this sort of personalized prevention is more understanding of the genetics of individuals that predispose them to certain kinds of cancer or make them at less risk for cancer. And that is now just starting to happen. We're just starting to get in that topic of, should we sequence individuals to sort of determine their of a certain cancer? And that is a topic where we don't know the answer yet. We're still trying to do research in this area. You know, in specific populations, germline assessment is very, very useful, but, you know, whether or not everybody should be getting that kind of testing, we don't think that's the case yet, although one can imagine a time in the future where that may be something we do, as we personalize screening based on genetic risk.
We're speaking today with Dr. Norman Sharpless, director of the National Cancer Institute at the National Institute of Health, the leading cancer research funder in the world. Now, I'm not sure, Dr. Sharpless, that the public knows how large the research enterprise is, 3,500 researchers working at the National Cancer Institute, and I believe over 37,000 members of the American Association for Cancer Research. And beyond our borders, there's a global community that's engaged in research. And I'm wondering if you could tell us a few things. How's the funding look? And also, what's the collaboration across borders look like, for information that I think our listeners would be excited to know about?
Let's start with the funding. I think biomedical research in general and cancer research in particular have been well supported the last few years. So we've seen increases to our budget. You know, for the NCI, for example, our total budget now is on the order of $6 billion a year. A few years ago, it was $5 billion a year. So we've had a nearly $1 billion increase to our budget. So that represents a broad bipartisan support for cancer research in the United States. You know, I have the opportunity to speak to lots of people in Congress, and just about everybody thinks we need to be doing cancer research and thinks this is a good use of federal funds.
That's good to hear.
So the report,
Lucky you.
The support for cancer has been pretty robust. You alluded to the ability to collaborate internationally, and this is really important. You know, as I mentioned, some of these entities that we're really interested in, some of these kinds of cancer are just sort of too rare to study in any one hospital or any one state or even any one country. And so if we really want to make progress against a disease like glioblastoma or pancreatic cancer, we really can benefit from international collaboration. And the NCI is a big supporter of that. We have ways of supporting international endeavors in cancer research, and then we also collaborate with other international funders of research in a variety of ways, because we really believe that if progress against cancer is a benefit for all of humankind, you know, cancer does not end at any certain border, and we want to make progress as expeditiously as possible, and we think that international collaboration and sharing of data is a key part of that. You know, in terms of the best practices of how you get, you know, good cancer care out in the community so that it's used routinely, this turns out to be a more frustrating endeavor than I would have imagined. You know, when I was a cancer center director, I had a more limited knowledge of how cancer care was done in a specific health system. But now as NCI director, I appreciate that while, you know, cancer care in the United States is in general quite good, it can be uneven. And a real challenge for the NCI is to make sure, and this is a research question, by the way, is when there is an effective therapy, why doesn't it get used appropriately in the community at all times? Why does it disseminate quickly enough? So understanding how we use best practices of cancer care as identified and implement them through our practice is an interesting research question where the NCI is some funding. So we have 70 NCI-designated cancer centers that are supported by the NCI. For the most part, they all provide excellent care and are places where the science is great, where the cancer care is great. But the problem is, or a problem, is that a lot of patients don't live near a cancer center. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to drive, you know, 5 hours back and forth each time they have to get to see their doctor. And so we really need to take the care that is quite strong in many of the cancer centers and figure out how to get it out into the community so that everybody gets great care.
Well, you know, over these years, we've had the Cancer Moonshot and the 21st Century Cures Act, and then the project that we're probably the most familiar with, the All of Us Precision Medicine Initiative that Dr. Collins launched. And in participating in that, what I've been really struck by is what a remarkable job they've done of engaging the public in this, speaking around the country, both at professional meetings, but also pushing this out to consumers to enroll people. And it seems that their ability to engage people in thinking about this as a issue of concern to everybody is kind of fundamental to their success. And I'm curious, at the NCI, and what is the NCI doing in that realm of engaging the American community in thinking about your research and supporting your research?
Wait, right. So first off, the NCI is one of the NIHs, so I'm on the same campus as Dr. Collins, for example. And because of that, we are a supporter and a user of an effort like All of Us. I mean, we certainly expect that massive study to lead to a real wisdom and knowledge mm-hmm. related to cancer, particularly, you know, the sorts of diet and exercise yep. and their relation to genetic risk, which are very hard to study by other means. So All of Us may be a very useful trial for the NCI. We have great hope for, you know, what that'll be able to teach us. The community that cares about cancer is very large and vibrant. Everybody's either been personally touched with cancer or has a relative, and there are people that have a lot of interest in what the NCI does. And we vigorously embrace the advocacy community. Yep. I spend a lot of my time trying to meet with advocates and patients to make sure that the NCI, you know, really keeps our eye on the ball, so to speak. So the communication, I agree with you, is critical to the success of the endeavor, particularly in a very heterogeneous, complex thing like cancer, where there's so many parts to it, and we, you know, we need to be making sure we address the issues of 100% of patients. It's why we spend a lot of time and effort on it. One of the reasons why I come on radio shows like this, that, talk about the NCI and make sure everybody understands our goals.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Norman Sharpless, director of the National Cancer Institute at the National Institute of Health, leader of the National Cancer Program, the world's leading cancer research funder. You can learn more about their work by going to cancer.gov, or you can follow them on Twitter at the NCI, or you can follow them directly at NCI Director. Dr. Sharpless, thank you for your dedication, and to your colleagues as well, to advancing this critical area of science, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you for having me. A real pleasure today.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Representative-elect Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tweeted that $21 trillion worth of Pentagon accounting errors could finance two-thirds of Medicare for all. It can't. The misguided tweet is based on a tally by university researchers who found $21 trillion worth of untraceable transactions in the Department of Defense between 1998 and 2015. It's a legitimate problem the Pentagon says it's trying to fix. But transactions, which can be counted multiple times as they pass through accounts, are not the same as spending. In fact, the U.S. actually spent a total of a little over $9 trillion on defense in those years. Even if the U.S. had eliminated the entire defense budget for those years, that wouldn't cover two-thirds of Medicare for all. Ocasio-Cortez, an incoming Democratic representative, supports the Expanded and Improved Medicare for All Act, a House bill that would expand Medicare into a universal health care program. An Urban Institute analysis of a similar plan proposed by Senator Bernie Sanders in 2016 put the cost to the federal government at about $32 trillion over 10 years. As for the $21 trillion in Pentagon accounting errors, as Ocasio-Cortez put it, that's a reference to research by Mark Skidmore, an economics professor at Michigan State University, and Catherine Austin Fitz. The two looked into trillions of dollars worth of unsupported journal voucher adjustments identified by the Office of the Comptroller at the Department of Defense. In testimony before the House Armed Services Committee in January, David Norquist, the Pentagon's comptroller, acknowledged this was a problem, but he said characterizing it as lost money is inaccurate. This isn't missing or wasted money that could simply be reallocated to other government functions, like healthcare. These are transactions. Every time the money is moved, it gets counted. So the $21 trillion figure is double and triple counting the same funds. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Asthma is one of the leading causes of trips to the emergency room for children, and there are often a correlation between high-density, low-income neighborhoods and more trips to the hospital for treatment and intervention. When officials at Boston Children's Hospital noticed a spike in asthma outbreaks in certain neighborhood clusters, they decided to do something about it. They launched the Community Asthma Initiative. They realized that if you could treat the environments in the patient's home, that might reduce the need to treat the patient in the emergency room.
The home visiting efforts work with children and families that have been identified through their hospitalizations and emergency room visits as an identification of having poorly controlled asthma, and also it's a teachable moment.
Dr. Elizabeth Wood heads the program and says the first step is to identify the frequent flyers, those kids who make repeated trips to the emergency room. Then they match with the community health worker who visits their home several times and assesses the home for asthma triggers.
And they work on three areas: understanding asthma itself, understanding the medications and the need for control medications, and then working on the environmental issues.
Families are given everything from HEPA filter vacuum cleaners to air purifiers, and the homes are monitored for the presence of pests or rodents. The result, says Dr. Wood, has been pretty dramatic.
What's remarkable is that there was a 56% reduction in patients with any emergency department visits and 80% reduction in patients with any hospitalizations.
The program has been so successful, it's being deployed in other hospital communities around the country. The Community Asthma Initiative, a simple reshifting of resources aimed at removing the cause of disease outbreaks in the community, leading to healthier patient populations. Now that's a bright idea. You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.